Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How safe are we from infectious diseases? For a few glorious decades in the 20th century, advancements in medicine seemed to promise a future nearly free from communicable illness. We cured once deadly bacterial infections, sterilized surgical suites and drinking water, and eradicated the ancient scourge of smallpox. Yet as we continue to battle HIV, E. coli, and brand new threats like SARS and swine flu, it is clear today that we are hardly out of the woods. And it turns out that some of our best-intentioned efforts to eliminate disease have only served to make the germs harder to kill. Madeline Drexler writes for a variety of national magazines and newspapers and is a former Knight Science Journalism Fellow at MIT. Her new book is called Emerging Epidemics, The Menace of New Infections. Madeline, welcome to Think.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So living in a globalized world means, as we know, that people and information can travel very fast, but then so can disease. So one strike against us is that infections don't stay local anymore.
That's right. Infections don't need visas to cross borders or continents. Actually, as SARS showed in 2003, within a few days after it had radiated out of China, it was already on virtually every continent.
And we also tend to live in pretty crowded places these days, at least the majority of the human population, and different kinds of diseases thrive in different population densities.
That's right. Well, there are more and more what are termed megacities arising in Africa and Asia and other places. And these are real incubators for new infections because, as you mentioned, the conditions there are very crowded, and oftentimes they're very poor, so that basic public health measures, clean water, access to medicines, other things like that are missing. And so these are other factors that cause these to be just places where emerging infections can radiate out.
Now, we are still in a better position to deal with bacterial illnesses these days than viral. Will you talk, give us just sort of the layperson's understanding of what makes these two different in terms of how they make us sick?
Well, that's a complicated question, but it's complicated science. I'll try to boil it down. Viruses make us sick by hijacking our cells. Some scientists don't even like to call them organisms because they really are not self-sufficient. They need our cells and the metabolic machinery of our cells to reproduce themselves. And it's our body's reaction to their presence that makes us sick. Bacteria are one-celled organisms. They can do it all. They can swap genes among each other. They're very wily adversaries. And they make us sick by often producing toxins or other things that kill our cells and make our immune system react in different ways.
So the reason it's easier to make an antibiotic than an antiviral is that if you use an antiviral, you might also be damaging healthy cells.
That's right. You could be killing cells. And there are very, very few antivirals on the market today. The whole spectrum of antivirals versus antibiotics is very striking in their differences. I think we may have the most antivirals against a particular disease, HIV/AIDS, but that has been through a really concerted effort since the time that disease arose. As for antibiotics, although when we're talking about the fact that it's easier to kill bacteria than viruses, actually there have been very few new classes of antibiotics against bacteria as well. I think the last new class of drug was in the year 2000. Before that, it had been almost 40 years before that a new class of antibiotic was developed. And this very new drug in 2000, antibiotic resistance emerged against it within a year, so it's had a very short shelf life.
And part of the reason for that is that for every human generation of 20 years or so, bacteria can evolve and change literally thousands of times.
That's right. These are amazing organisms, and they adapt far better to people than we adapt to them. So, as you mentioned, because of that very timeline, natural selection operates much more efficiently in the microbial world in a dozen people. That's right, people produce a new generation every 20 years or so, and bacteria every 20 minutes or so, and viruses even faster. So they have this fantastic genetic variety in their communities. And, you know, that means that there are more possible mutations that will enable them to thrive when the circumstances change.
So what changes now that we're putting antibacterial agents in everything from soap to toys to grocery cart handles?
Well, some scientists, and there's really evidence about this, suggest that that may be actually making it more dangerous for us. There's this idea that's known as the hygiene hypothesis that suggests that actually we need exposure to bacteria of all sorts when our immune systems are growing, so particularly children, in order to prime our immune systems to be healthy when we're older, and that young people who do not have exposure to dirt, to playing out in the dirt, and you know, and other sort of messy environments, are more apt as adults to get asthma, to get allergies. And also, the other danger is that you could be, through the chemicals in these toys and other things that you've mentioned, you could be possibly breeding drug-resistant bacteria that and drug resistance on your skin, so that later on when you're in a hospital and you really need a particular antibiotic to work, it may not.
And a lot of the bacterial strains that are found in infections that people acquire in the hospital are, in fact, resistant to drugs.
That is a very scary scenario. That's right. I mean, many of the sort of the most virulent infections in hospitals, but including staph infections, which are the most common infections in hospitals, are virtually completely drug-resistant. And staph is the one that doctors worry about most, because staph is, you know, it's on our skin naturally. It's in our noses and our mucosal linings. And if that were to become fully drug resistant and invade our bloodstreams as it naturally does when we have invasive surgical procedures, it would utterly change medicine, because surgeons would have to think twice before doing anything, before doing elective procedures, you know, like hip replacements or removing cysts, because they would fear, you know, life-threatening infections. It would mean that more people would die in hospitals. You know, you would have whole wards possibly being closed up. And even just in, you know, in healthy people in the community, even as we're seeing today with this community MRSA, methicillin-resistant staph, these harmless skin infections can be fatal if they're not treated promptly with the right drugs, or if there are no drugs to treat them and they invade the blood.
I think it's hard for people who were born any time after the middle of the 20th century to remember or imagine what the world was like pre-antibiotic. Can you talk about the potential that we might actually get to a place where we are post-antibiotic?
Well, if we're post-antibiotic, we are pre-antibiotic.
Yeah,
you saying that
if they all stop working?
If there are no antibiotics that work against the major infectious diseases, I mean, it's... what can I say? It was a not uncommon occurrence for a man to be shaving, for example, and you know, you perhaps strafe a part of his skin and die of a disease called erysipelas, which is a strep infection. Children just were accustomed to losing playmates to infections that are easily treated today. I think people have no idea what a pre- or post-antibiotic age would look like.
So we know that people love to go to the doctor and get an antibiotic when they don't feel good, and sometimes these are appropriate, and often they are not. Is this something you think that needs to be legislated more carefully, or can this be handled by the medical community really putting its foot down and saying, we are not going to prescribe where it is not called for?
Well, the government has issued guidelines for prescription of antibiotics, and so, for example, if a patient is in the ideal world, if a patient is coming in with what clearly to the doctor looks like a viral infection, and most coughs and all colds and all flus are viral. They are not bacterial infections. Most people, unless they have specific risks for certain pneumonia or other bacterial diseases, should not be getting an antibiotic. But on the other hand, in the real, and actually since the government, since the CDC has issued those guidelines a few years ago, antibiotic use has gone down for those particular indications. But, you know, in the real world, sometimes you go to a doctor, you're feeling just terrible, and many patients demand antibiotics, and in order, I don't know, to keep that patient or to avoid any kind of possible malpractice, the doctor will prescribe antibiotics. So there's a social, behavioral element in this too. It's in all realms of public health. It's very hard to enforce guidelines like that.
Madeline Drexler is my guest. She is a science journalist whose new book is called Emerging Epidemics, The Menace of New Infections. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Jeff Whittington is here in the studio with me now. And of course, we are taking a quick pause for our winter membership campaign. We have thus far raised $379,000, and we need to get to $600,000 before we can finish fundraising this time around. You can help by calling 1-800-694-6931. Maybe you can give $15. Maybe you can give $1,500. Maybe you can give $15,000. If so, great. We'd love to hear from you now. You can do this on a credit or debit card. You can write a check. You can set up a sustaining membership, which is a monthly draw from your checking account. Whatever you want to do, we would just love to hear from you now. 1-888-694-6931. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris, and hello to you. Thanks so much for tuning in today and staying tuned for the Think program. In spite of the membership campaign, this is another great conversation, Chris, with Madeline Drexler about her book and her work. The book's called Emerging Epidemics, and we can thank you with your very own copy of the book when you join the station today at the $120 membership level. It's just $10 a month if you use the sustaining membership program, and over 7,000 KERA members are sustaining members. It's very easy to do. You just set up the paperwork, and it's a affordable monthly transfer from your bank account right to KERA. Of course, you can go get the book. It's out in paperback. It's available. You can get it from your local retailer or your favorite online retailer. However, you want to find out more about Madeline Drexler's work. But we're just saying, you know, if you join the station at this level, we'd be happy to say thanks with this thank you gift.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. Of course, you can do this also online at kera.org. You know, public radio, I guess we can't call it an experiment anymore, but it started as a sort of grand experiment. People got together and said, wouldn't it be great if we were to create this network of broadcast stations that exist to serve the communities in which they operate? And what if they were paid for largely by contributions from those people? If you were to try to start this today, somebody would laugh at you and say, you're insane, it'll never happen. Well, in fact, it did happen, and it's really a tribute to you who listen and who understand that we are only supported and only in existence thanks to listener contributions, that we're still here. You can make it possible for the next generation of people to listen to public radio. Frankly, you can make it possible for the next year of public radio that you enjoy when you call 1-888-694-6931.
It is a pretty optimistic idea that it works, but it does work. And it is risky. It's a risky thing to spend the time and resources bringing you the programming that you get on KERA and then hoping that you'll do your part.
We trust you.
So we trust that you'll call 888-694-6931 or join online at kera.org.
I want to thank Paul Hartman in Dallas, Tommy Doan in Allen, Sherry Nayer in Arlington, and you if you're making that call right now. Again, the phone number is 1-888-694-6931. You can go online to kera.org. Back in just a couple of minutes with Madeline Drexler.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is a one-time night science journalism fellow at MIT, Madeline Drexler. Her new book is called Emerging Epidemics, The Menace of New Infections. Join us by calling 1-888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org. I want to talk for a minute about things like mad cow disease and, of course, the human equivalent, which is Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. This is neither a bacterium nor a virus, but something else altogether.
Right. This is something called a prion, a protonaceous particle. Scientists had known a bit about the prion-like diseases earlier than when mad cow emerged. There was a disease called Kuru, which was again another horrifying neurological disease among cannibals in parts of Africa. And so what makes this such a astonishing and in a way confounding, you can't call it an organism, an entity, is that it's, for one thing, it's very, very difficult to kill. That's why when mad cow disease first emerged, it was because of actually turning down the temperature in the rendering process in Britain, and that just that small temperature change allowed this organism to proliferate, and of course it got into meat, into hamburger meat, and this is actually an instance where public health worked well once that disease was fully understood, or at least initially understood. We don't fully understand it. They simply changed the way they did meat rendering and other things in Britain, raised the temperature, and although many people had been silently infected, the epidemic curve, the number of new cases just kept going down and down and is continuing to.
Yeah, what's interesting about this is that unlike other foodborne illnesses, where within a matter of days after you've eaten something contaminated, you start to feel very sick, whether it's a virus or a bacterium, with a prion, your immune system doesn't respond at all.
That's right. So it's a kind of silent epidemic. They're usually neurological in nature, but there are other silent epidemics that are caused by viruses. Are just as deadly. The preeminent example being AIDS.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people have decided that maybe eating meat is not a safe thing because we hear about these outbreaks of different problems. But vegetables and fruits are contaminated at least as often these days.
That's right. You just can't win.
You've got to eat something.
New food economy. You're right. The problem is in many ways similar. With meat, you have contamination with the intestinal contents, the feces or other intestinal contents of the animals that are being slaughtered. With even organic, but with fresh fruits and vegetables, you may have contaminated irrigation water or rinse water, and that water may be contaminated by nearby farm animals. So sanitation is just absolutely key, especially in this sort of global food economy.
And many times it's hard to trace the source of an outbreak until a lot of people have been affected because our food comes from so many places.
That's right. There's a statistic somewhere that a single hamburger can contain the meat of literally hundreds of animals, and from up to four continents they've done traceback studies like that. And so you're right, you don't really know where your food comes from. We do know that more and more of the American food supply comes from abroad. More than, I believe, 3/4 of our fruits and vegetables are grown abroad, where sanitary measures may not be up to the standards as they are here.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to James in Irving. Hi, James.
Hello. Yes. Well, first off, I'd like to say I agree that we have been giving out too many antibiotics over the years. However, I have a question. It's really puzzling to me that, of course, last couple of years or so, you go to the dentist and it's all changed. Some don't even give antibiotics. And it's, they explained to me that the cardiologist had made this decision. And my question would be, how did it become a cardiologist's duty to do this instead of the people at the infectious control disease centers who would, make these determinations on the kinds of bacteria or infections that would cause problems with folks having dental work, instead of cardiologists who are not trained in it at all. That's my question.
Yeah, thanks, James.
It's a fascinating link. Who would have thought that a dentist would have anything to do with heart disease, right? But this is one of the new areas in infectious disease research. They're finding that there are infections in parts of our bodies that may affect very different parts of our bodies. For example, people with gum disease are known to have much higher risk for heart disease. And the reason is that there may be, and they really change their minds a lot about which organism may be the culprit here, but there may be organisms that are in gum disease that may move through the bloodstream and cause inflammation in the heart. In fact, a lot of doctors feel that heart disease, many cases of heart disease may in their foundation be infectious diseases, some sort of persistent bacterial infection perhaps. So that's the gum disease, heart disease link, and I believe there are other connections with gum disease too. So I didn't know that dentists were using antibiotics for doing dental work or periodontal work, but there would be a theoretical reason why they would.
I think it is recommended, or has been in the past, routinely for people with things like heart murmurs, and I am certainly not an expert.
And mitral valve prolapse.
Right.
And then I believe they withdrew those recommendations recently because of the other problem that you mentioned, Chris, which is antibiotic resistance. By giving people these antibiotics for an effect that may or may not happen, they're engendering antibiotic resistance, and I think they found that except for serious prolapse or murmurs, that actually these antibiotics have, on balance, have worse effects because of nurturing resistance than they do in preventing infection.
So you talked, Madeline, about the fact that we're starting to discover that things like heart disease, and in the past were believed to have no link most of the time to any kind of infectious disease, do in fact have a link. Talk for a minute about there are certain kinds of cancers and there are stomach ulcers, and we're learning a lot more about pathogens that might actually cause illnesses believed once to have a very different cause.
That's right. Well, in the U.S., about 70% of deaths are due to chronic diseases, and more and more the scientists are finding that many of these big diseases may be caused by infections. So you mentioned cancer. The cervical cancer, about 90% of cases of that are caused by the human papillomavirus, and thus the new vaccine that's come out. Liver cancer, about 60% of those cases are caused by hepatitis B virus, and peptic ulcers, gastric ulcers, Helicobacter pylori, this spiral-shaped bacterium, is behind most of those cases. So whereas 30 or 40 years ago, doctors would always prescribe a bland diet and milkshakes and things like that for peptic ulcers, now they just give a couple of antibiotics and the disease is cured.
It's nice to know we can do that now. It's awful to think about people who suffered for so many years and just didn't eat any spicy food for decades.
That's right.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll move on next to David in Plano. Hey, David.
Hi, Chris. Great show as always.
Thank you.
I'm surprised no one's asked this yet, but I'm kind of curious to know what the guests' thoughts are on antibiotic use with cattle, I guess, for the most part, for beef and dairy products and how that affects our immune systems. I know that was kind of something, an issue that's come up, and it causes people to reconsider their diet or dietary habits. Is that really a problem that we really need to think about and focus on more? Because it seemed to have been a forefront issue a few years ago, and now I don't really hear anybody talking about it anymore.
Thanks for a call.
Mm-hmm. Well, the farm connection is a huge issue. in antibiotic resistance. And you're right, there was more attention in the media to it a few years ago than it is now, but it is no less a problem. As David was mentioning, the antibiotics are routinely fed in tiny amounts to farm animals, and it's not to fend off disease, but it's to boost their growth. And this widespread use of these antibiotics in turn fosters these drug-resistant forms of infections in people who eat the meat or poultry and get infected first. So, for example, Campylobacter, which is in chickens, is the most common bacterial cause of foodborne illness, and Salmonella, and E. coli. If those organisms are drug-resistant, it means that when we go to the hospital with those infections, doctors have a very hard time treating them. And a few years ago, the FDA banned a class of drugs called fluoroquinolones in poultry production because they wanted to reduce the prevalence of fluoroquinolone-resistant Campylobacter. So a good public health measure, right? And doctors, they prize this class of drugs because these are sort of broad-spectrum, low-toxicity medications, they're slow to breed resistance. But unfortunately, even after the FDA decision banning fluoroquinolones, and even after poultry producers removed this drug, recent studies have shown that drug-resistant microbes still persist in the population even after exposure to the drug has been ended. So it's ending up being a very complicated problem that may take many decades to reverse.
Madeline Drexler is my guest. She is the author of a new book called Emerging Epidemics, The Menace of New Infections. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send an email to think@kera.org. Jeff Whittington joins me now. He is senior producer of Think and host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know. And Jeff has for you the magic number.
It's 1-888-694-6931. 1-888-694-6931 is the number to call to contribute to the station. Was that the number you were looking for?
Yes, okay, that is the magic number.
As I kind of raced in here. the other magic number is a little over $200,000, which is left to raise. Once we reach that, it's over. The drive is over at that instant. We've got to get to the $600,000 goal, and we're getting back on track, Chris. We've been encouraging you to call. $380,000 is raised, so it's $220,000 left to go to make the overall goal for the drive. You might choose to pick up your very own copy of Madeline Drexler's book, Emerging Epidemics, when you join the station at the $120 level, or at any level over $100, we can send you Ken Burns' series, National Parks. It premiered on PBS last fall. 6 DVDs, 12 hours of incredible historical footage and also new footage of some of the greatest treasures that this country has for you to experience right there on the screen in the comfort of your own home. So please give generously. Anything over $100, we can thank you with that Ken Burns set.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also go online to kera.org. If you are a fan of dance, we have a wonderful opportunity for you from Texas Ballet Theater. There is a performance, I believe it is March 12th at 8 o'clock, and we have pairs of tickets to see Romeo and Juliet, the ballet, performed by Texas Ballet Theater at the brand new Opera House in downtown Dallas. Those are available with a $200 contribution to KERA. We do have a limited number of those tickets. However, if you call us now and make a credit or debit card pledge of $200, I believe we do have several pairs left, so you can take advantage of that offer. The number, 1-888-694-6931. I should mention, by the way, these are orchestra seats.
Yeah.
You can also make a contribution online at kera.org.
You know what is amazing, Chris? The ballet, it's in 3D.
No glasses required. You know,
right.
I had to leave Avatar the other day because I became motion sick. Watching the movie, this is a true story, but that won't happen at the ballet.
No, it's real human beings on stage performing right before your very eyes in fabulous 3D.
You might be sick of the shape of your body when you watch all these beautiful dancers, but that's the only thing. You know,
what a great offer.
It's
what
a wonderful thing.
It is a great offer, though, and those are going to go really, really quickly. So don't hesitate. Call 1-888-694-6931 to get those tickets.
Thanks so much to Tim Dotwil in Fort Worth, Diane Mumpower in Plano, Mr. and Mrs. Kenneth Levine in Fort Worth, also Beverly Pitchford in Dallas, Beth Minton in Dallas, and Francine Lyons in Arlington.
We'd love to thank you. If you call 1-888-694-6931, go online to KERA.org. Your contribution right now goes right to work, especially if you use your credit or debit card. It goes right to work funding the station that you've already chosen to use. We just do this a couple of times a year, and this is one of those times. So, you know, if you've already contributed, if you contributed in the fall drive, or maybe you contributed last spring, how about an additional gift for the station? Because you've heard so much that you've, you know, information and news that you've used over the last year. You know, how about an additional gift? A lot of people are doing that. To help us speed the end of this drive, to help get there that much sooner. Your contribution right now really does help us get that much closer, and you and then everybody else, all the people in their cars around you or in the offices around you or the homes around you, when they all join, you know, it happens that much faster. That's the magic of public radio. It's not all on your shoulders, but we are asking you to take part of that responsibility at whatever level is right for you. But when you join, other people hear your name. Other people hear that we've made that much more progress on the goal. And they think, well, you know, I want to join this winning team as well.
You know, there may be some of you out there who love public radio. You listen all the time. You even root for us during the drives. But you sit there and you think to yourself, well, I'm not going to give them money. I hope those other people make a contribution. We're talking to you. In fact, we're asking everyone who listens to KERA to make a contribution. Now, if you want to do, you know, a very small amount or an amount that's really affordable to you, or you want to do thousands of dollars, that decision is up to you. But we are quite literally asking everyone who listens to KERA regularly.
You.
That is you. To make a contribution at 1-888-694-6931. Chip in a few bucks, see how great you feel, and see if it doesn't make you feel like part of the team.
And of course, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much for your contribution. Whether it's $100 or $500 or $1,500 and you're a member of the Friends group here at KERA, really, thank you very, very much to everyone who's called or contributed online. We'll be back with another segment with Madeline Drexler, author of Emerging Epidemics. But you still have time to call 888-694-6931.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Science journalist Madeline Drexler is my guest. Her new book is called Emerging Epidemics, The Menace of New Infections. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also reach us via email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from, this one is from Paul, who writes, isn't it true that all antibiotics are doing is selecting out those bacteria that have not evolved to be resistant? Thus, the evolution to be resistant would have happened anyway, even without the antibiotics.
That's a pretty thorny scientific question. I can answer it partially.
Okay.
First of all, antibiotics come, the source of most antibiotics is fungi, other organisms in the soil. So in one sense, they have already been exposed to other bacterial defenses just from those soil organisms. So in a sense, he's correct, but there's just no question that the profligate use of antibiotics in the human medical armamentarium has engendered new kinds of resistances. And these bacteria can swap genes in just the most amazing ways. They have a great repertoire of ways to transfer genes among each other and actually engender multi-drug resistance in each other. So I think the answer is more complicated than simply their natural evolution. Human medicine has definitely cast its own effect.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we'll speak with Penny in Irving. Hello, Penny.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on the gentleman that talked about using antibiotics in dental work. And it's basically a concept of chronic inflammation in your body. The link has been established between especially gum disease and heart disease, but also diabetes and low birth weight in pregnant women, miscarriages in pregnant women. And so in certain cases, definitely it would be recommended that antibiotics be used when dental work is done. I also wanted to talk about just the fact that it's very important that patients are online and on board when doctors explain to them that really antibiotics are not recommended. A lot of times excessive use of antibiotics comes from the pressure that's put on doctors by patients expecting to get something from their doctor's visit.
Thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate it. Madeline, I'm guessing you probably don't disagree with much of that.
No, I agree with everything the caller said.
We would be remiss here if we didn't talk a bit about vaccines. Sometimes, especially with viral illnesses, better than trying to treat it after someone is already sick is preventing it in the first place.
That's right. For example, the flu vaccine, when it's a good match with the viral strain that's going around, it can prevent 70 to 90% of the infections. But vaccines are very difficult to make, both from a sort of scientific, technological point of view, and also from a financial perspective. We can see that even with the flu vaccine. This problem has played out dramatically with the H1N1 pandemic. There is no good modern regular use production method for a flu vaccine. We're relying on old ways to make the vaccine with eggs. And the point is that companies and the government did not invest in modern technologies to make that vaccine, which could also be a basis for making vaccines for other diseases as well. So the problem is that vaccines in general, as you were suggesting in your question, are a low-profit sort of not very attractive economic proposition for drug companies.
There are also a lot of people who distrust the idea of vaccine science, and they feel like there is more harm to be suffered than good to be gained. Is that a failure? First of all, is there a reasonable basis in fact of that concern? And if not, is it a failure of the medical community to really communicate what these things do in our bodies?
That's a complicated question. To answer the first part of the question, there is no suggestion that these vaccines are causing autism or some of the other illnesses that people are worried about. But it's a very difficult concept to communicate because when a child has had a vaccine and then suddenly stricken by something, it's hard for any parent to fathom that. It's a matter of the overall odds that it wasn't a specific cause and effect. Forgetting the second part of your question. Oh, public health communication.
Yeah.
This was a very tricky matter, actually, during the H1N1 pandemic. The government could have made a decision fairly early on last summer to use these, for example, these adjuvants, these boosters in the H1N1 vaccine, which would have greatly amplified the supply of vaccine that we had. They decided not to, for that very reason, Chris. That there was, they understood that there would be, from a small segment of the community, this explosive anger and fear that this vaccine would cause other illnesses. So it's a very difficult public relations, sort of public communication issue.
Your sense, we've been told over and over for the past several years that we are sort of overdue for a deadly pandemic akin to what happened in 1918. Your sense is that H1N1 was not that deadly pandemic.
Well, thank goodness it was not.
Yeah.
H1N1, surprisingly, I think to everyone's astonishment, turned out to be a very mild pandemic. It is a true pandemic. It is a brand new strain of the virus to which no one had immunity, but it is mild. In fact, it's even more mild than the regular seasonal flu. The CDC published some statistics a couple of weeks ago saying that about, I think it was a bit over 11,000 Americans had died from this pandemic, H1N1, so far. But in a regular flu season, about 36,000 Americans die just from seasonal flu. So this strain is even much more benign, if you can call it that, at least much less virulent than regular seasonal flu. But in a way, besides obviously fewer people dying from it, it's good in another sense too, because it's a wake-up call rather than a true public health emergency. So the question is, what have we learned from this pandemic?
And was it, having watched it from a distance, was the response pretty appropriate?
The response was good in many ways. As with any sort of unfolding epidemic, scientists and public health officials are working with partial knowledge, so they have to make decisions on the fly based on, you know, the best knowledge that they have. And I think, in general, the people I've talked to suggest that they made good decisions in regards to allocating the vaccine, trying to do that in a most fair and a sort of and with a much with as much of a public health rationale as they could. So that was good. The real flaw was that there was not enough vaccine, and that's why I was saying this was a wake up call. What if this had been like the H5N1 bird flu in Asia? That virus kills 60% of its victims. What if that had been the pandemic strain of flu? The fact that we hadn't invested in these new vaccine, in these so-called third-generation vaccine technologies years ago, meant that it would have been in a way a scandalous indictment of government support for public health that we hadn't, if that had been the pandemic strain.
Did you struggle, this is the last thing I want to ask you, when writing this book with being really freaked out by all these scary diseases, or is that something you had to overcome years ago in your career?
No. I don't know what it is. Somehow writing itself kind of inoculates you sometimes against the subject that you're writing about. I think I didn't really make any major changes in my own life. Maybe I steered away from salad bars, but that's not it.
Well, you sound hale and hearty, and we really appreciate you spending the time with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Madeline Drexler's new book is called Emerging Epidemics, The Menace of New Infections. We do have copies of the book available this afternoon when you call 1-888-694-6931. This is a thank you gift that we are offering at the $120 contribution level. You are welcome to make that contribution with a debit card or a credit card. You can even set up a sustaining membership, and you can do those things either online at kera.org or by calling 1-888-694-6931. Hello, Jeff Whittington.
Hello, Chris Boyd. And hello to you. We've had a great couple of shows today, I think, and this is your chance to support those shows. Make that call, 888-694-6931. Go online to kera.org. And don't forget, there is that fantastic Ken Burns DVD set. It's a 6-DVD box set. Each DVD is 2 hours long. It's the National Park series that you may have seen part of, or maybe saw it all, but you'd just like to have your own copy of it on PBS last fall. It is phenomenal. I've been watching it.
It makes you proud to be an American. It seems like a funny thing to say. Of course, we're all proud, but it really does stir these extraordinary feelings of patriotism.
Isn't the subtitle Our Best Idea? Or
the National Parks, Our Nation's Best Idea or something, yeah.
It's so amazing, the history behind these parks, the footage that Ken and his incredible team of producers and cinematographers were able to capture. Some of the images just knock my socks off. You can get your very own copy of this 12-hour series when you join the station at a level above $100. And I keep saying that because $100...
Don't limit yourself.
Yeah, $100 is all you have to contribute. But really, dig deep and be generous, because we'd love to send this to you. We'd really love also to wrap up this membership campaign, and that's going to require a $150 pledge or a $200 pledge. So 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. And Chris, speaking of a $200 pledge,
Oh, yes. At the $200 contribution level, we have these amazing tickets available to the Texas Ballet Theater's performance of Romeo and Juliet, which will take place March 12th at 8 o'clock at the Winspear Opera House. If you have not yet had a chance to visit these new jewels of the Dallas Arts District, this would be a wonderful time to take advantage of this. We are starting to reduce the number of pairs that we started out with. We had 15 in the beginning. We've had some interest in these. So if this is something you want to do, orchestra seats, a pair of them, available with a donation of $200 or more right now to KERA. If you want it, you could just round up and do a $240 contribution, and then you know, in your head, you think, okay, for every month I listen to KERA, it's $20.
Yeah, it's as affordable as you want it to be, and there are a number of ways for you to make it even more affordable. I want to say thanks especially to Nola Miley in Fort Worth, Lucy Spalding in Flower Mound, and Margaret
Muir.
Margaret Muir in Dallas. Speaking of national parks.
There you go. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also make a contribution online at kera.org. There's no prize for holding out. You know, we're not selling you timeshares here. Contributing to public radio is a good thing to do, and you should feel great about it. You don't need to feel like, oh, I'm going to let those other people do this, and I'm not going to be taken in. This is not a sales pitch. This is a request for your cooperation to keep the station going. There's a very big difference in my mind.
Yeah, you've already figuratively bought the product because you listen,
right,
and you use it. And we're offering you the same deal we offered almost 2 weeks ago. And every time we do a membership campaign, just do whatever it's worth to you. Just do something. Don't sit around and do nothing. Do something to support KERA.
And it can't be worth nothing to you because you spend your time with us. And the one thing that nobody has, no matter how much money you earn, no matter what part of town you live in, no matter what you do for a living, we all get 24 hours in a day. And those 24 hours are equally valuable to each of us. If you spend your time with KERA, it's hard to understand why you wouldn't spend at least a bit of your money making sure that it remains strong and vibrant in your community.
1-888-694-6931 is the number to call, or contribute online at kera.org. If you've heard one of the authors earlier this week on Think, I'm thinking of Donovan Campbell and Joker One, or any of the guests we've had who've had a thank you gift associated with their interview, those are all still available. You can check them out online at kera.org, or when you call 888-694-6931, the very friendly person you'll talk to, we'll be able to walk you through the membership process, and if there's a thank you gift you're interested in, they'll find it and make sure that you're able to get that.
In the next segment here, we are going to run the Rick Steves special. It is a phenomenal 2-hour interview with Rick Steves. We have lots of thank you gifts associated with Rick Steves himself, including this amazing, I'm still really stunned by this, at the $240 level, we have this big package of gifts, which includes 3 of his books, 2 of them recently updated, 1 of them brand new, called Travel as a Political Act, plus this giant package of DVDs, which include every single segment he has ever shot for PBS, including a lot of the ones that hit the cutting room floor, plus all the full episodes of Travel with Rick Steves. That's something like 80 television episodes all over the world.
Yeah, it's an amazing offer, and you're going to hear all about it here in a few minutes. But if you remember, if you heard the special, this is a great opportunity right now to go ahead and make that call. 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org.
Your contribution doesn't have to take a lot of your time. The amount of money is up to you. You know, think about the other things that you spend money on that keep you informed. Maybe your cable bill, or maybe what you spend for your smartphone, or magazines, or books. I know for a fact that a lot of you listen to the people we interview on the show and then head out and find copies of their books. If this is something that you've done before, if you've spent, $25 or $35 several times to read those books, why not knock that much money back to KERA, the source that that told you that you'd want to check them out in the first place?
And when you do call 888-694-6931, you'll be supporting 90.1 KERA, your source for NPR news. It's KERA Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton, and streaming online at kera.org, where you can make your contribution there as well. It's very safe, very secure, and your e-gift comes zooming across the giga, right into Pledge Control Central.
Through the tubes of the internet.
That's right. You got to love that giga.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. Of course, you can go online and make a contribution at kera.org. We know that a lot of you are not interested in thank you gifts, and that's fine. We've put your entire contribution to work on the programming. However, if a thank you gift appeals to you, check it out online or ask the folks that answer the telephone. They know all about them. The number again, 1-888-694-6931, or you can go online and make a secure contribution at kera.org. Your support really counts for the station, and we do appreciate it. Thanks.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.